So, good morning, everybody. As mentioned, my name is Sarah Vero, and I'm coming to you from Kansas State University. So what I'm really presenting here is the very early stages of the project. I've actually only been at Kansas State since May, so I'm afraid we're high on the concept and methods development and project setup here, and a little lower on the results, but very much here to discuss and see how we can move forward as Kansas State towards a critical zone approach to our research. So I always like to borrow this diagram from the Critical Zone website, as we know here that the Critical Zone incorporates everything from the treetops to the bottom of the groundwater, and this is the area in which all life exists. So it's really, when we approach the Critical Zone from a research perspective, it needs to have a broad strokes approach, and it needs to have a lot of interplay between the different departments. At the moment I'm with the Department of Geology, which is strange because I'm in fact a soil scientist and a vadose zone hydrologist. There's been a lot of hydrological and hydrogeological research at Kansas Prairie, and it's been very, very focused on bedrock evolution, bedrock dissolution, groundwater quality, and the nutrients that are showing up there. But as I'll describe later, it's a little hard to disentangle what's going on in our groundwater, particularly with regards to the dissolution, if we don't have a better handle on what's going on in the vadose zone, because that's controlling much of the chemical, water and gaseous transport to that lower zone. So, as you know, the EPA has defined the Great Plains as one of the 13 US ecoregions, and the Flint Hills, in which Kansas Prairie is located, is a sub-region within that. It is in fact one of the remaining tall grass prairies in the United States, and the reason that it has remained as tall grass prairie while much of the rest of that landscape was intensified and used for agriculture is really because of the bedrock. We have an interbedded shale limestone bedrock, and it's much more undulating than the rest of the former prairie, and as a result it's simply very, very difficult to till. So it got abandoned to prairie as such. So if it's such an anomaly, why do we need to study it, and why do we need to move towards a critical zone approach there? Well, as you know, we have three intensively managed landscape sites, the IML network within the CZO program. But if we don't have a reference ecosystem of an undisturbed prairie, how can you evaluate the changes that have occurred on those landscapes as a result of intensification? And it's for that reason that we want to promote Kansas Prairie and the research that's being done collaboratively between Kansas State University and the University of Kansas as really a reference ecosystem against which those other landscapes can be evaluated. So Kansas is controlled by a number of factors, but the three major ones that we've been looking at since 1978 are bison, bedrock and burning. And on Kansas we have a multi-watershed approach. It's been in long-term ecological research since 1972, but it is still not a critical zone observatory, although we have many of the components that your critical zone observatories consist of. Our treatments include unburned catchments, catchments which are burned annually in either spring or fall. In fact, we have our fall burn kicks off tomorrow, and then we have burning at 1, 2, 4 and 20 year intervals. In addition to that, we have watersheds which have been annually burned for the last 20 years and are now being switched to a non-burning scenario, and we have unburned watersheds which are now being switched to an annually burned scenario, so we can evaluate the changes of those two different approaches. So what is the state of current knowledge regarding Kansas Prairie? There's been a huge amount of research. I believe there's over 1,000 papers which have been published incorporating research at that location. We know that fire and grazing and the combinations thereof constrain or maintain C4 species, and they constrain the woody expansion, which is the other major threat to tall grass prairie in addition to intensification. The work by Bremer and Ham in 1999 really unraveled the surface energy balance, the temperature and evapotranspiration dynamics as a result of burning. However, that study was limited in length to just over 150 days, and it was also limited in depth. They really looked at the top 50 centimetres. And this has been the case in much of our watersheds. We've looked very, very intensively at the surface, the top 50 centimetres, and very, very intensively at our bedrock, but we're missing the vast amount of the vadose in between. And I'll talk a little bit in a while about why that is, but essentially, as much of you know, the vadose is difficult to study. In addition to that, we know from our atmospheric, we have a NEON atmospheric monitoring station at CONSA, and we know that we have an increasing atmospheric CO2. And what's very interesting is how is that translating through the soil profile, and what is that going to be the consequences for vadose zone processes and on into the groundwater bedrock zone. So that's our surface status. The vadose, for me, there's millions of questions in this zone relating to CONSA. Below 10 to 50 centimetres, we really don't know what are the long and short-term effects of fire, of prairie burning on energy balances. We know that there's going to be a short-term effect of intensified evapotranspiration and intensified temperature as a result of burning, so immediately during and after the burning. But from modelling studies, we know that that doesn't penetrate very deep into the soil profile, about 5 to 10 centimetres. However, there may be more subtle long-term effects as a result of changes to poor water dynamics and as a result of changes in our evapotranspiration patterns. And that may, and certain studies show that that may have an influence deeper within the profile. Crane and Nippert studied that in 2014. They did show in one watershed that there was a long-term soil drying effect as a result of cessation of burning up to 75 centimetres. Now, that watershed was one of the ones that I mentioned earlier which had been annually burned and are now not burned whatsoever. But that's a very extreme example. We know in reality, whether it's prescribed burning or wildfire burning, you rarely go from an annually burned to a never burned scenario. You might have an increasing space between your burn frequency or a decreasing space between your burn frequency. So really that study has provided us an indication of what's going on, but we need a more detailed approach in each of our watershed treatments in order to really unravel that and build upon that information. Our third point here, our groundwater residence times increasing as a result of soil moisture drought. So whether or not you have an atmospheric or precipitation drought, you may have an effective drought to groundwater as a result of water taking a longer time to percolate through the vadose zone. And that kind of links back to our second point, that if there is a drying effect, even if you have the same amount of precipitation, if it's not infiltrating to the groundwater, it's all going to be the same. For me, as a soil hydrologist and a soil physicist, I'm very interested in how does burning change the hydraulic conductivity and the sorptivity throughout the profile. There has been some work on this validating that it does have an effect, particularly in the upper horizons, but again, because of the difficulty in excavating soil pits, particularly in an area such as CONSA, which we're trying to preserve and not traffic overly, we don't know fully what are the effects deeper within the profile. And finally, coming around to the carbon eventually, how does the burn frequency affect the total carbon and the labile fractions? There has been work by Chuck Rice and his team which have shown that burn frequency and soil burning does affect the soil aggregation, but we have not expanded that and how does that change the water retention curve and the hydraulic conductivity. So my hypothesis, I suppose, as someone who is very new to a prairie environment, is that if you are burning it, you're changing the size of your soil organic particles, which may make them more prone to percolation through the vadose zone, which may change your soil structure, not just at the top 50 centimetres, but right down throughout the profile. So essentially, while we have lots of individual discrete studies, we have no holistic complete statement on what is the total effect of burn frequency on vadose zone behaviour. Moving down into our groundwater, really going to focus on the 2008 study by McPherson et al., which was done from the University of Kansas, and they observed a 20% increase in groundwater CO2 over 15 years and a 13% increase in alkalinity. And they outlined a number of hypotheses in that paper as to why this might be. And all of those hypotheses pointed towards something is happening in the vadose zone and we don't know what it is. It could be that there's a microbial or a vegetative respiration occurring, in which case there's CO2 being generated in the vadose zone, which is passing through to our groundwater. Or there could be some sort of an amplification effect of changing atmospheric CO2, which is becoming increased or somehow magnified through processes in the vadose zone. And I think they stated it very well when they said there is an as yet unexamined link between the atmospheric CO2 cycle and the shallow groundwater. The difficulty is that to date we haven't had the tools at CONSA to really look into this, and that's been what my role has been. And I'll just round up this kind of overview section with a comment on our bedrock. As I mentioned earlier, we have interbedded shale and limestone. Our hill slopes are very undulating, so they change from relatively deep soils at our toe slope and some of our upslope positions to exposed karst on the hill slope, on the side of our slopes. So it's quite a complicated landscape. McPherson et al. Identified an increased dissolution of calcite and dolomite, and they identified that that was driven by the CO2. So essentially, in addition to an evolving vadose zone, which is changing as a result of burning, we simultaneously have an evolving groundwater and groundwater bedrock zone. So it's a very, very dynamic environment, and if we want to have one statement for how does the Konza, a conceptual model for Konza hydrology, we need to incorporate these two regions, as opposed to the strictly groundwater-focused approach that we've had in the past. So just to synopsize it here, as you can see, all of the questions eventually lead back to the vadose zone. And as I mentioned, we really had the vadose zone has been instrumented to varying degrees in our different watersheds to 50 centimetres and minimal instrumentation between 50 centimetres and the bedrock below. So I actually came from Ireland. I was working on the nitrates directive and water flow. So this was my initial concept as someone arriving to a prairie ecosystem, that we had prescribed fire and or wildfire, which would change the carbon amount, form and mobility, which should go on to change the structure and then on to the hydrology and nutrient transport. So my big questions were, what are the changes in water and gas chemistry, in carbon content and form, and in the vadose-zone pore structure? And what are those effects over the short term, as in sub a year immediately after burning, and longer term over a decadal scale? So our materials and methods as such, we decided that we needed a number of tools to approach this. This would incorporate vadose-zone monitoring, profile and landscape characterization to assess past changes, and hydrologic and conceptual modeling, which would incorporate those previous two. I'm going to skip on slides a little bit, but here are the vadose-zone monitoring pilot arrays which we installed, down to just over a metre. We have two of these installed, and we've applied for funding to install more of these over all of our watersheds. These include moisture sensors, matrix potential sensors, pore water and gas samplers, and high-resolution O2 sensors as well. And what we're hoping is that this will be a tool in which we can hang other research projects to get a more comprehensive integration of surface and bedrock groundwater measurements. I have a few photos here, but I realise I'm pressed for time, so I'm going to skip on, just showing some of the installation and some of our testing. And this is our finished data logger. This site is going to be burned tomorrow, so if this conference was a week later, I would have had some more results to show you, I guess. But our early results show that we have fairly steady moisture content in the upper layers during a non-burned time, but excitingly, lower in the soil profile, we do have spikes in water content. So this suggests that there's some sort of preferential flow going on. And we really didn't know this from the earlier research, which only went to 50 centimetres. We didn't really tap into this. Here's our O2 data. Again, we have very stable oxygen content. If you look at the blue lines, that's our water content and our oxygen in the upper horizon. It's pretty stable and atmospheric, nothing too exciting or unexpected there. But we see deeper O2 is exhibiting this rather dramatic gulping behaviour, which is really not related to the water content of that horizon, which is the typical assumption is that your gas is controlled. If it's not filled with water, your pores are filled with air. That's actually not the case here. So there's some sort of a gaseous interaction beyond the moisture. And this could be microbially controlled or controlled by structure. And we're hoping our deeper characterization will allow us to unravel that. That's some very exciting new work. Our profile characterization, I'll skim past this, but we have a very comprehensive analysis going on. These samples have been taken for different watersheds, and we're processing them through the laboratory. And what we're hoping to do is to incorporate, as advised by the Critical Zone Observatory Network, to input the measuring and the monitoring steps to allow us to develop a conceptual framework for prairie hydrologic evolution. Here's just some of our collaborators and some of the measurements that we've been focused on. And here's a list of our collaborators. And this is not a comprehensive list, but these were the people who were involved in the early stages of the project. So as you can see, it's a big job, and we're trying to incorporate the various discrete agencies within our university and within other universities. And we're very keen to collaborate with other universities and other critical zone observatories, which may be dealing with either similar or comparable or contrasting areas, so we can really unravel what's going on. So thank you very much, and I'd be happy to take any questions if we have time. quietly.
Until later in the discussion.
Thank you.